This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know around here we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to school to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
With the new year, changes in laws, in prices, and maybe in yourself. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Washington, D.C., I'm Kimberly Adams in for Kai Rizdal. It's Monday, January 2nd of the brand new year. Good to have you along as we start 2023. With the start of the new year, all over the country, new laws kicked in. In California, the state's landmark consumer privacy law expanded as of yesterday, thanks to a ballot measure that voters approved in 2020. It builds on existing privacy law, requiring companies to disclose what data they collect from consumers, how they use it, and with whom they share it. It also gives California residents the right to request their data be corrected, deleted, or not sold at all. But now these existing requirements also apply to employers. Marketplace's Megan McCarty-Carino has more on what that will mean.
If you've ever encountered those boxes on the bottom of virtually every website asking your data privacy preferences, you know, California privacy law has far-reaching effects. And its application to employers now will too, says employment attorney Darcy Grodin with Fisher Phillips.
Given the vast amount of data that California employers have about their employees, just by nature of the employment relationship, is going to be very tricky.
The law applies to employer data from an employee, job applicant, independent contractor, even an emergency contact who resides in California. While many companies already have infrastructure for dealing with consumer data, the employment relationship is much more involved, says Grodin.
There's just a lot of constantly catching data in the employment context.
You've got your HR file, healthcare, emails, surveillance footage. All of these will need to be accounted for, which means a lot of additional work for HR departments, says Lothar Dieterman, an attorney at Baker McKenzie who teaches privacy law at UC Berkeley.
This law is very complex. It's going to be costly to comply with it.
Zoe Argento, an attorney at Littler Mendelson, says it will be a particular challenge for companies that aren't consumer-facing, like manufacturing and construction companies.
They typically don't have a privacy department, so this is very new to them.
Companies that have a lot of workers and collect a lot of data, like gig platforms, could also be significantly affected.
Those companies are just such a black box.
Lindsay Cameron is a management professor at the Wharton School. She says more disclosure could bring greater transparency about how these platforms use worker data to program their algorithms. But the disclosures, like those boxes at the bottom of every website, will likely be such a fire hose they might not mean much to workers.
There's no way a worker can really make an informed choice around it.
But she says the data could help people like her who study worker privacy. I'm Megan McCarty-Carino for Marketplace.
The markets are closed today because of the holiday, but that doesn't mean the economy stops. We'll have more details when we do the numbers. This year, the federal government will start spending more than $42 billion to improve high-speed internet access. While states and tribal communities are clamoring for their slice of the new funding, they're also racing to beat a January 13th deadline if they want to challenge the accuracy of the new broadband access map that will be used to divvy up the resources. Marketplace's Savannah Marr joins us for more on that process. Hi, Savannah.
Hi, Kimberly.
The Federal Communications Commission's new map replaces a version that a lot of advocates complained was inaccurate. What specifically was wrong with the old version?
So that old map was based on census data. It assumed that if even just one household in a whole census block was served by an internet provider, then the whole block was adequately served. And that system works fine in sort of densely populated urban areas. But in rural parts of the country, a census block can encompass hundreds of square miles, and that one served, all served shorthand can end up overstating how much broadband is available.
So what's different about this new map?
So this time, the FCC discarded that old system, and it contracted with a company called CostQuest to create what it calls a serviceable locations fabric, which is basically just a map of every location in the U.S. where retail internet service is available. And then the FCC asked internet service providers to report what kind of service they offer at each of those locations. So this map is relying on much more granular data.
Okay, so this new map is just a draft. What else might need to change, and what's the process for doing that?
Yeah, so state, local, and tribal governments, and even individuals can submit challenges to the FCC if they feel the data in the map aren't accurate, but they have to do it by the 13th. Some states like New York and West Virginia have already submitted bulk challenges saying that hundreds of thousands of addresses are either missing from this map or their access is being misrepresented. Other states like Texas have announced they won't challenge the map, and instead they've encouraged local governments to tackle that.
Advocates are still having some problems with even this new system. What are some of the specific problems people have with the challenge process?
Well, one major limitation of the process was pointed out to me by Harold Feld, who's with the digital advocacy group Public Knowledge.
There's a clear irony in saying that you have to be able to access online the broadband map in order to be able to demonstrate that you don't have broadband.
So obviously, this format isn't very friendly to the most underserved communities. But also, the parts of the country where broadband isn't readily available also tend to be the places that don't have a lot of resources or a whole lot of capacity to put towards this challenge process.
But clearly, a lot of people are very invested in paying attention to this, and it's not without controversy. So what are the stakes here?
Yeah, the digital divide is a really stubborn problem in this country, and the pandemic has showed us how critical broadband access is for allowing people to access education and healthcare and participate in the workforce and the broader economy. But our understanding of where improvements are actually needed has been really fuzzy. This is a more than $40 billion investment from the infrastructure law, and it should be an important milestone in closing the divide. But it's hard to solve the problem without good data and without a good picture of what the problem actually looks like.
Marketplace's Savannah Marr, thank you so much.
Thanks, Kimberly.
It's the time of year when a lot of people are trying to make some significant life changes, perhaps by cutting alcohol or other substances. But for a lot of people, taking a break feels impossible because what they thought was just a bad habit is actually a full-blown substance use disorder. Dr. Joji Suzuki is the director of addiction psychiatry at Brigham and Women's Hospital. Dr. Suzuki, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
In preparing for this interview, you mentioned to my producer that you felt there was a flaw in treating people with substance use disorders, particularly in terms of how physicians are educated and how the treatment field works. Why is that?
Yeah, so that's a long, complicated journey, but to
put it quickly, we essentially, for the last 100 years, treated, you know, addiction, substance use disorder as a moral failing or a criminal justice issue and not as a healthcare issue. What that does is, number one, is you have an entire workforce of individuals who don't really know how to assess, diagnose, or treat substance use disorders. That's one. But the flip side is that despite having no formal education, we were actually educated through the informal education that we received, which is that, you know, we don't treat these people. They're not our responsibility. Now, again, things have changed dramatically in the last decade, but we still have a long way to go.
Since you brought up the workforce, what is the consequence for our workforce, our, the U.S. labor force, of all of this untreated or undertreated substance use disorder, on both with opioids and with alcohol use disorders?
Yeah, I mean, so there's been an addiction workforce crisis in this country forever, meaning clinics that treat substance use disorders are perpetually understaffed. They are underpaid, low morale, high burnout, high turnover, because the demand far exceeds the supply. The government conducts a survey every year about substance use disorder. It's called the National Survey of Drug Use and Health. And each year answers many, many questions. But one of the questions they answer is, of those who have a substance use disorder in a given year, how many of them access any type of treatment? Inpatient, detox, outpatient, medications, AA meetings, whatever it is. What proportion of them actually access treatment of any kind? It's less than 10%.
Wow.
For mental health conditions like depression, it's about 50%. For physical health conditions like diabetes, it's probably 70, 80%. So we do a pretty decent job of capturing individuals with chronic diseases like diabetes. We're not as good with depression or other psychiatric conditions. But for substance use disorders, it's dismal. And in fact, that hasn't changed at all in the last decade. It's been consistently around 10% or less.
If only 10% of the people with a substance use disorder are getting any kind of treatment, you have to imagine that's showing up across every single industry in terms of productivity, in terms of absenteeism, in terms of just how we're interacting in the workplace.
Oh, yeah, no doubt about it. And, as the number of overdose deaths climb, and, you know, we saw the largest number of overdose deaths ever recorded in a 12-month period in the United States in the past year, you know, exceeded 100,000 a year. It's never been that high. It continues to grow. If you don't treat substance use disorders, more aggressively, provide evidence-based care, allow for access to treatments, to encourage more folks to actually be open to treating substance use disorders, these things that we're experiencing right now, the increase in overdose deaths and alcohol use and suicides, they could continue to get worse.
If so many people with substance use disorders are not getting treatment for that disorder, how are they interacting with the medical system?
So they may not be coming to the healthcare system for treatment, but they still present to the healthcare system for other reasons. Because as we've already talked about, substance use disorders lead to accumulating negative consequences. That's both physical and mental, consequences. And so the hospitals around the country and the emergency rooms around the country at any given day, and you can talk to anybody who works in a hospital and they'll tell you, a good proportion of those individuals actually are there because of the consequences of drinking or drug use. So despite these individuals not seeking treatment, we actually treat their medical psychiatric consequences all the time. Yet we don't take those opportunities as opportunities to start treatment, offer treatment, to link them to treatment. And that's one of the areas of my research and focus is how do we utilize, for example, the emergency room encounter to actually start treatment? How do we utilize the hospital admission to identify individuals who may be interested? And so overall, I feel like that's been one of the areas that's been lacking, but I'm really working to try to change.
Dr. Joji Suzuki is Director of Addiction Psychiatry at Brigham and Women's Hospital. Thank you so much for sharing your expertise.
Yeah, thank you. Glad to be here.
This interview is an excerpt from the latest program from Call to Mind, American Public Media's initiative to foster new conversations about mental health. You can hear substance use and new paths to recovery on many local public radio stations starting this month, and find more information and resources online at calltomindnow.org. Coming up.
And they were all just staring at the sky, and they're like, are there always this many stars in the sky?
And they're so pretty. But first, let's do the numbers. Markets were closed today in observance of the New Year's Day holiday, but let's take a final look at the numbers for the year we just tucked in and put to bed. The Dow Jones Industrial Average lost about 8.8% this year. The S&P 500 was down 19.4%. And the NASDAQ fell 33.1%. Looking ahead, the chief of the International Monetary Fund, Kristalina Georgieva, tells CBS News she expects one-third of world economies to be in recession in 2023. At least gas prices aren't as high as they were. AAA says the average for a gallon of regular stands at $3.21 a gallon. A year ago, we were at $3.28. You're listening to Marketplace.
This Marketplace podcast is supported by Gusto. Look, payday's awesome, but running payroll, calculating taxes and deductions, staying compliant, that's not easy. Unless, of course, you have Gusto. Gusto is a simple online payroll and benefits tool built for small businesses like yours. Gusto gets your team paid while automatically filing your payroll taxes. Plus, you can offer benefits like 401k, health insurance, and workers' comp. Just for listening today, you also get 3 months free. Go to gusto.com/marketplace. That's gusto.com/marketplace.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kimberly Adams. A lot of government protections and financial programs that started during the pandemic, like eviction moratoriums, child tax credit payments, and enhanced unemployment, have since gone away. Now, as many as 15 million people who started Medicaid coverage during the pandemic may be about to lose that as well through a process called redetermination. Blake Farmer of WPLN in Nashville reports.
Like many people on Medicaid, Anisha Love of Clarksville, Tennessee, didn't qualify until she was expecting.
It was because of the fact I was pregnant.
Tennessee's Medicaid program, known as TennCare, covered her during her pregnancy in 2021. Then her son, who was born on New Year's Eve, automatically received coverage too. His parents give him a tickling at the foot of their bed. He's all smiles, happy and healthy, but Love is concerned. She's 24 and supports her family with a part-time job at a retail pet store, along with some cash assistance from the government. She says it's hard to imagine she could afford their medical bills if they had to get other coverage that requires copays and deductibles.
I've been trying to get another job that pays a little bit more, but it's not been successful because I've been having to take care of my son.
Love's family is one of the nearly 20 million added to Medicaid rolls during the pandemic. People haven't had to go through the annual renewal to make sure their income and health still qualify them because state programs were not allowed to drop anyone during the pandemic. The Kaiser Family Foundation estimates states spent about $47 billion in extra coverage, but they received an additional $100 billion from the federal government to cover those costs. Medicaid programs like TennCare have been trying to warn people that a day is coming, likely in the next few months, when the public health emergency is declared over and the annual income reviews restart. TennCare Director Stephen Smith says in Tennessee, everyone needs to keep an eye on their mail for a bulky packet.
We want all eligible members to remain eligible, but eligibility is dependent upon providing the necessary information to TennCare.
The state uses a complex income formula to determine eligibility, and TennCare and some other state Medicaid programs have had problems handling this paperwork, even in normal times. The Tennessee Justice Center has ongoing litigation representing families who lost coverage during the last round of redetermination through no fault of their own. Executive Director Michelle Johnson says forms just never showed up.
We had thousands of clients who reached out to us in the context of this, and many of them had never moved. They didn't get the packets. So we're very concerned.
The concern is especially high for people of color on Medicaid. According to the government's own data, Latinos will make up more than a third of those who are being disenrolled despite being eligible for Medicaid. Civil rights groups have banded together to ask that Congress step in and simplify the process where it can, like making states automatically renew some patients who already qualify for other programs like food stamps. Stan Dorn is health policy director of Unidos US.
States definitely, in some cases, are going to feel pressure to knock people off the program to save money.
Republican governors have already asked the White House to end the health emergency because of the cost.
And if somebody's ineligible, absolutely, they should be terminated from Medicaid and transition to another program. But people who the state has reason to know are eligible should not be terminated because of missing paperwork. That's just wrong.
Dorn says at this moment, it should be the government's job to prove people no longer qualify for Medicaid, not the other way around. In Nashville, I'm Blake Farmer for Marketplace.
The economy of northern Minnesota along the shore of Lake Superior depends on tourism. Visitors flock there in the summer to camp and canoe, and later in the winter to ski. Now, during this slow, dark time of year, locals are trying to lure a new, growing demographic, so-called astro-tourists. Here's Dan Crocker from Minnesota Public Radio.
On the far northeastern tip of Minnesota, Travis Nowitzki likes to walk to a place where a gnarled, centuries-old tree seems to grow straight out of the rock.
So right now we are standing on the Lake Superior shoreline. We hike down to Manido Gijigants, which is Ojibwe for Little Spirit Cedar Tree.
This is a sacred place on the reservation of the Grand Portage Band of Lake Superior Chippewa. Visitors must be accompanied by a tribal member.
It's a great spot just to sit and take in what's going on around you.
It's only about 7 o'clock at night, but it's dark. Every few moments, the moon and a blanket of stars emerge from behind fleeting clouds. This is one of Nowitzki's favorite places to pursue his passion, photographing the night sky.
Sitting on the shoreline of a lake, seeing the stars reflected in the water, is an experience unlike anything else. Throughout day-to-day life, you know, which can be pretty hectic sometimes, it can be hard to kind of quiet your mind. And coming out to these places, whether I'm taking photos or not, is just that way for me to kind of slow down, take a breath, just be in that moment and appreciate it. You know, just you and the sky, you and the stars.
And increasingly, more people are venturing to remote, dark places like this to share in that experience. 5 years ago, tourism officials here published an online map of good spots to view the northern lights. They launched a dark sky festival in early December during the darkest time of year. Lodges offer stargazer packages at more than $200 a night. Tourism marketer Kirsty Vick says she first realized the appeal of the region's night skies when she was sitting around a campfire a few years ago with out-of-town friends. All of a sudden, it got really quiet.
And they were all just staring at the sky, and they're like, are there always this many stars in the sky? And it was kind of eye-opening for me, for somebody who grew up in this area and always saw this many stars in the sky, that not everybody gets to experience this and not everybody gets to see this.
Scientists estimate 99% of Americans live under light-polluted skies. Nearly 80% of North Americans can't see the Milky Way. And as the world gets brighter, dark sky tourism has grown. Valerie Stimmick-Bailey, author of the Lonely Planet book, Dark Skies, A Practical Guide to Astrotourism, says it's hard to quantify that growth, but she says it was clearly boosted by the pandemic.
astrotourism actually benefited because there is no better activity for getting out and getting away from people than stargazing. And so there was a ton of increased interest in finding stargazing spots and going to national parks for night sky activities.
Photographer Travis Nowitzki sees that increased interest firsthand. He says spots he used to have all to himself now might have another half dozen cars there. And he struggles with that. He knows some of those people are probably there because of him and all the photographs he's taken over the years of the night sky.
The more people that come to experience that makes it harder to continue to get the same experiences that I'm used to and why I love it. But at the same time, it's rewarding in a sense because I know that those folks, they're there because they want to experience a piece of what I experience.
That sense of wonder, of feeling infinitely small, but also a part of something so huge and so humbling. In Grand Portage, Minnesota, I'm Dan Crocker for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, with the new year comes a pay bump for minimum wage workers in many parts of the country. The Economic Policy Institute looked at all the new state and local laws and figures more than 8 million workers are getting a raise. The biggest increase is in Nebraska, where the minimum wage will go up $1.50 to reach $10.50 per hour. The smallest hike is in Michigan, with a 23-cent raise to get to $10.10 per hour. For what it's worth, the federal minimum wage is still $7.25 an hour, as it has been since 2009. Here's your moment of economic context. Another item going up in the new year, in addition to wages in some places, we have higher Social Security payments coming down the pipeline. But also, quite relevant to many seniors, higher drug prices. Reuters reports that drug makers are planning to raise prices on more than 350 different drugs this month. Over the course of 2022, the companies raised prices on more than 1,400 drugs, the most since 2015. Our daily production team includes Andy Corbin, Richard Cunningham, Nicholas Giong, Maria Hollenhorst, Sarah Leeson, Sean McHenry, and Daisy Palacios. I'm Kimberly Adams. We'll see you tomorrow, everyone. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.